Well, my goodness, what do you say to a man who thinks that it's okay to kill babies? I asked him, was it a good thing when a specific Israelite sword was run through a specific Amalekite baby? Was that a good thing? He didn't say, yes, it was a good thing. He did tell us it was a good thing that Onan was killed. I'm just glad that God's positive law, as he states it, has changed, and that things like that are not done anymore. I just wonder if it ever occurred to Mr. Deaver that it's possible that God really wasn't doing those things, that the people just thought that they were doing these things in the name of God, and that God wanted them to do it. I brought with me something that I want to take just a moment to read, to show to you that the Israelites were no different from the nations around about them. The Moabites believed that their god Chemosh led them to victory in battle. The Canaanites believed that their god Baal favored them for this event or that event, or that the tribal god punished them whenever they were doing something that was displeasing to them. What makes him think that the Hebrews were any different in their conception of their tribal god? Have you noticed that he wants to assume, he wants to argue from the assumption that the Bible is true, that everything that it says is true. And I'm simply not going to let him do it. If I find a place in the Bible where it indicates that God was jealous, or God was vindictive, or that God wasn't gracious, it doesn't satisfy me for him to say, well, over here in such and such a chapter, in such and such a verse, it says that God is good, that God is gracious. Because that would only mean that the Bible contradicts itself. And that's the whole point. It's been mentioned every night that I am the publisher and editor of a quarterly journal that's called the Skeptical Review. If any of you would like to receive that, I'd be glad to mail it to you and give you a free subscription to it. And you'll see that in each issue, we concentrate on the exegesis, and I'm going to claim, Mr. Deaver, that that's the correct word, the exegesis of contradictions, discrepancies, and inconsistencies in the Bible text. And we even give men like Mr. Deaver the opportunity to look at our articles before we publish them and to write their responses to it. You'll find that in every issue. That the Bible is an inconsistent, contradictory book is something that's recognized by every reputable Bible scholar. And by reputable Bible scholars, Mr. Deaver, I don't mean someone that attended Tennessee Bible College or graduated from Abilene Christian University or Harding University. I mean men who have devoted their lives to careful investigation of the biblical text and all related evidence. Not one of them would tell you that the Bible is this wonderfully inerrant, consistent book that Mr. Deaver believes that it is. And he thinks that he takes care of every situation by just saying, well, it might be true that this says this at this particular place, but it can't mean what till means, because over here in such and such a chapter, in such and such a verse, it says so and so. Well, the only thing he's proven is that I'm right when I say that the Bible contradicts itself. It's laughable for anyone to take the position that the Bible is a harmonious work. I'm holding in my hand a book that I know Mr. Deaver is very familiar with, Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties by Gleason Archer. They trot to this every time that anyone points out an inconsistency in the Bible text. And Mr. Archer is very good, as most men like Mr. Deaver would also be, at coming up with far-fetched, how it could have been scenarios to explain away some obviously glaring inconsistencies in the Bible. So I hope that as this debate progresses, that when I cite what a specific passage says, that Mr. Deaver will try to examine that text in that specific context and not point to me another chapter and another verse where it says something entirely different from that, because I'm going to admit to him that he can do that, and he can do that simply because the Bible contradicts itself. Now I'm going to take an example that he's referred to and show you what I mean. I mentioned it last night, I believe, or perhaps it was the night before. Hebrews 6:18 says that it's impossible for God to lie. Titus 1:2 says that God cannot lie. But those of you who were here that night will remember that I referred you to 1 Kings, the 22nd chapter, that gives a specific instance of when God did lie. And I want to refer you to it again. I'm not going to summarize the entire story. I assume that if you were here, you remember how that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, wanted reassurance that their alliance, when they went up to Ramoth-Gilead, would succeed. And so they called forth prophets and asked if they should go up, and they said yes. But Jehoshaphat wanted the word of at least one more prophet. And so Ahab reluctantly brought in the prophet Micaiah. And I want to read to you what he said. And when we come to that part where Micaiah tells the little yarn about what he saw in heaven, I want you to bear in mind that this was not taking place down in hell. And it wasn't Satan sitting on his throne with all of his beings around him, that it was Yahweh, the tribal God of the Hebrews, who was sitting on his throne in heaven. If you have your Bible, would you turn again to 1 Kings, the 22nd chapter, and let's begin reading with verse 16. After Micaiah had sarcastically said, "Yes, go up, you will prevail," we have this. "And the king said unto him, How many times shall I adjure thee that thou speak unto me nothing but the truth in the name of Jehovah? And he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And Jehovah said, These have no master, let them return every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, Did I not tell thee that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? And Micaiah said, Therefore hear thou the word of Jehovah." Now notice what he said. Hear the word of Jehovah. "I saw Jehovah sitting on his throne. I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne. And all the host of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left." Now Mr. Deaver wants to do the Flip Wilson routine, if you remember that, if you're old enough to remember it, where he had his character Geraldine, who always justified everything by saying, "The devil made me do it. The devil made me do it." This says that Yahweh was sitting on his throne, and that all the host of heaven were standing by on his right hand and on his left. And Yahweh said, "Who shall entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one sat on this manner, and another sat on that manner. And there came forth a spirit and stood before Yahweh and said, I will entice him. And Yahweh said unto him," wherewith? In other words, How do you propose to do that? And he said, that is the spirit that came forward, I will go forth and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. I want to remind you that this says that this scene was taking place in heaven, that Yahweh was on his throne, and that all of his heavenly creatures were around him. He was talking to them. He was not talking to any angels of Satan. As Mr. Deaver apparently wants us to believe that the passage was teaching. And Jehovah said unto him, Thou shalt entice him and shall prevail also. Go forth and do so now. Go forth and do so now. Now therefore, behold. This is Micah's summation. Now therefore, behold. Yahweh hath put a lying spirit. Who has put a lying spirit into the mouths of the prophets? Mr. Deaver said, oh, the devil did it. The devil did it because it says over here or somewhere in this place and that place that the devil is the source of all lies. Well, I don't care what it says over here and over there. I want you to deal with what it says here. And Micah said, now therefore, behold, Yahweh hath put a lying spirit into the mouth of all these thy prophets, and Yahweh has spoken evil concerning thee. Yahweh did it. Yahweh. Now you people are intelligent enough to believe that. Don't let him come up here and try to pull the wool over your eyes. In the questions that I gave to him tonight, this was the first one. If Agag, the king of the Amalekites, had brought his army against the Israelites and except for King Saul, had killed every man, woman, infant, suckling, and all but the best of the Israelite livestock, because don't you see? That's what 1 Samuel 15 says in reverse, that the Israelites did this to the Amalekites. So my question is, if the situation were reversed and the Amalekites had done it to the Israelites, would that have been an action that could have properly been called a moral atrocity? His answer, yes. Yes. But that didn't surprise me, because he's on record as saying, whatever God does is all right. But I want you people to think. I want you to think seriously. Did God really tell the Israelites to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites? Or did someone just think that they did it? In 1868, 13 miles east of the Dead Sea, an archaeologist discovered the Moabite stone. The inscription was translated, and it reads very much like a passage from the Bible, except it was written from the point of view of Moabites who believed not in the God of Yahweh, but in their god Chemosh. And I want to read part of the text to you, and I want you to notice how the people in that area believed. They had a tribal god, and this tribal god was on their side in battle, and that their tribal god was angry with them when they did wrong and punished them for it, just like the Hebrews believed. I am Mesha, son of Chemosh. Remember, Chemosh was the Moabite god. I am Mesha, son of Chemosh. K king of Moab, the Dibonite. My father was king over Moab 30 years, and I became king after my father, and I made this sanctuary for Chemosh at, and there is the name of the town here that the translators do not know how to pronounce. A sanctuary of salvation. For he saved me from all the nations and let me see my desire upon my adversaries. Who saved Misha from all the kings and let him see his desire upon his adversaries? Chemosh did. Chemosh did. He believed that just as much as David believed that Yahweh was leading him forth in battle to victory. He believed it as much as Joshua believed that Yahweh was leading him forth into battle and telling him to kill everything that breathed. Don't even keep the babies alive. And along comes Mr. Deaver and he says, oh, that was okay. That was okay. Because this supreme morality, Yahweh, he can't do anything wrong. He can have an Israelite soldier take an Amalekite baby screaming in terror on the ground and run a spear through it and kill it. And that's okay. Well, I'm going to say again, I'm very proud to say I do not believe that that was okay. I'm not a bit ashamed to say that I see that as a moral atrocity, so you people are going to have to make a decision. You're going to have to decide whether you're going to view this the way that I view it or whether you're going to view it the way that he does. But keep this in mind. Documents like the Moabite stone that I just read from indicate that this was just a general view of all of the people in that area at that particular time. They had their God, and they believed that their God led them forth to victory. Now here's a question for Mr. Deaver when he comes back. Let him explain to us why we should believe the Bible any more than we should believe the Moabite stone. It's a product that came out of the same time. In fact, this King Misha of the Moabites went on to describe a battle that's recorded, I believe, in 2 Kings, the 3rd chapter. Only in 2 Kings, the 3rd chapter, the Bible tells us that the Israelites won the battle. He claims here that they won it. Now, Mr. Deaver, tell us why we should believe what is in that book any more than we should believe what's written about that on the Moabite stone. People, don't you ever think seriously? I've talked to many of you. You're good people. Mr. Deaver is a good person. But don't you ever wonder about any of these things? Don't you ever read any of the documents that came out of that period? And don't you ever stop and think, well, gee, it just sounds like that tribe believed a lot like the Hebrews did. I'm going to read an inscription now that dates from the 8th century B.C. I believe we're getting back to about the time, well, it would be about 100 years before the prophet Isaiah. And this was King Ashurnasirpal of Assyria. And he had inscribed on the pavement slabs of an entrance to the temple of Uttra at Nimrud, in other words, a temple to one of his gods, this. At that time I received tribute of the land of Issala, cattle, flocks, and wine. To the mountain of Kashira I crossed to Kinabu, the fortified city of Hulei, I draw near. Listen very carefully. I want you to get a feeling for the thinking of that time. With the masses of my troops and by my furious battle onset, I stormed, I captured the city. 600 of their warriors I put to the sword. 3,000 captives I burned with fire. I did not leave a single one among them alive to serve as a hostage. Who lay I, their governor, I captured alive. Their corpses I formed into pillars. Their young men and maidens I burned in the fire. Who lay I, their governor, I flayed. His skin I spread upon the wall of the city of Damdamusa. The city I destroyed, I devastated, I wasted with fire. My time is up. I'm going to have to stop. But he went on to say that he was doing this under the authority of his God. Now, why were the Israelites any different from the people around them? Maybe that's something that Mr. Deaver can tell us. And I'm sorry, but my time is up.